What's up, everybody? You are listening and are watching Real Conversations with Jacob Young. Real Conversations, of course, is sponsored by Boys Town. Boys Town has been making a difference in boys and girls' lives through love, education, for over 100 years. And guys, if you're considering donating, please consider donating this year to Boys Town. Just go to boystown.org for all the information. And while you're there, please feel free to check out all their parenting tips that are there. RCJY is also sponsored by Lane Frost Brand, made for the champion in you. Every hat, every style, hoodies, and more. Something there for the whole family. Trust me, my wife, she has always been snagging my hats from me. So go to lanefrost.com, use Jacob15. You'll save 15% on anything and everything Lane Frost Brand. Now, guys, my guest this week is one of the most successful child actresses of the 1990s. She's appeared in TV shows like Beverly Hills 90210, Baywatch, Step by Step, Boy Meets World. She's received the Best Supporting Actress Film Award for her role in the hit movie Babysitter's Club. I love that film. She's also won a Youth in Film Award for her most recognizable role as Robin Russo in Nickelodeon's The Secret World of Alex Mack. Now, however, in her 20s, she faced some challenges like addiction and even homelessness. And now, in recovery for over 10 years, she counsels hundreds of addicts getting into treatment and founded San Fernando Valley Feed the Homeless, among her many charitable and humanitarian causes. Guys, my guest this week is the one and only, the extraordinary, Natanya Ross. Natanya, welcome.
Thank you.
I had a conversation with my wife this morning, and I said, you know, I have Natanya Ross on the show, and she's from The Secret World of Alex Mack. She goes, no, it's not The Secret World of Alex Mack. It's Alex Mack. That's what we called it. And I said, well, maybe that's a Maryland thing where you're from, but I'm not sure. Is this a true fact?
You know, yeah, I guess, yeah, it is. I mean, who wants to say that whole dang thing every single time? So it had like an acronym that I'm going to mess up, so I'm not going to even try. But generally speaking, Alex Mack is how we ran with it. Yeah.
You are such a fixture in the 1990s television world. You were working very, very hard at such a young age. Were you enjoying the work and feeling happy inside at the time?
You know, that's such an interesting question, and I have a couple different answers for it, but I started acting at 6 months old. Like, can you call that acting? I don't know. My mom, I think, determined at a very early age that I had something that she could make into something bigger. And by the time I was old enough, or I had like the cognizance to understand what my life was, it was just a part of who I was already. So I don't think I really like enjoyed it until I was in my teenage years, to be honest. I think most kids growing up, they go to like piano lessons, right? Or dance class or cheerleading or soccer, foot, whatever it is. And that's just what they know. And that's what acting was to me for a long time. And by the time I was really starting to enjoy it, some other stuff was developing in me that it was like a yin and a yang almost. I was like very rebellious against it, but I was also very much in love with it, because for me, it was really an escape from what was going on in my real life. And, you know, it was like my saving grace, yeah. I would say.
I want to talk a lot more about that, but let's just kind of back up a little bit to those early, early years that you're mentioning when you said you started such a young age, 6 months old, right? And I've been in television for many, many years myself, and I've had children on daytime television, and I've had twins and kids, and I've held them all, and their parents are there in the wings. Were your parents supportive in that way, or what was that life like for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I'm actually writing my memoir right now. So I'm going back into a lot of these formative years that are, it's hard to tap into that because so much life has happened since then to like tap back into that childlike state. But yes, my mom was very involved. She took me to and from all my auditions, set, all of that stuff. She really hustled hard to make sure I was going to have a successful career. She was really at the forefront of everything.
Well, that's wonderful that you had that she, well, she supported you. But you know, at 6 months old, you really can't make that decision that like, hey, that's something I want to do. Or even maybe at like, I've got kids that are like my kids now, because you know, I'm dad's an actor. They're like, hey, I want to do what dad's doing. And that's cool. I think that's awesome. But I also didn't think of that when they were that young. But but that's awesome that she was taking you around and you were able to have that common thread.
Yeah. You know, I mean, listen, there's so much more to that story, of course. But in those years, like when I think back of the best memories I have with my mom, because it got a little tethered later on, those are the years that I think about, you know, because it was really her and I against the world, and we're from New York, and I was doing all sorts of stuff in New York, and then we came out to LA. It's a whole other animal, and things were happening very quickly for me. So, you know, it was really her and I against the world, against LA, against Hollywood, and we were going to figure it out one way or another.
Well, that speaks volume for your talents, and of course your mom's belief too in herself and you and as a team, right? Was it, now you say it was just you and your mom. Was it, is your parents, were they separated at that point?
So no. So it's a really crazy story. So my dad was, you know, he was there. They were together. We're from Asbury Park, New Jersey. So
I know it well. I lived in New Jersey. I know New Jersey.
Okay. So since you know Jersey, you could probably figure out without me having to say it on camera what he did for a profession, mm-hmm. which, you know, was, yeah. So when we got the opportunity to come out to California, he was actually going through a lot of legal issues in Jersey. So it was, I don't know, it was like the craziest, most divine timing. But he did eventually come out to California a couple years later to live with us. He left when I was 14 and transitioned into being a woman. And I never saw him again, saw her again. So
ever again.
Ever again. So that's the story with my dad. And then, you know, it was me and my mom in L.A. And by that time, we had kind of established a life and a home for ourselves there.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I'm
Jacob, there's a lot.
There's a lot. I mean, we're going to have to definitely check out the memoir, because obviously there's going to be some details that you know, wow, that's really interesting. I have so many more questions about that, but we have so much we want to cover today too.
I know.
You've been open about your addiction issues, and you're also able to help so many people overcome theirs. Is there a way to help someone who isn't ready to be helped?
Oh, wow. Great question. You know what's crazy? Not a lot of people think to ask that question. Because when we're in the thick of trying to help a loved one, a family member, a spouse, stop doing what's killing them, right? What we're seeing is killing them. We sometimes want it more for them than they want it for themselves. So the short answer to that is no. You cannot help somebody who's not willing to help themselves, because they might go for, you know, for their husband, for their wife, for their mom, for their dad. But if they're not really going for themselves, it's not going to stick, you know, and that's one of the hardest parts of what I do, is having to be the liaison with the family and explain to them, like, look, your loved one just isn't ready. They're not ready,
right?
You know, and I know that from experience, because it took me so many tries till I was ready.
Yeah. No, I mean, addiction's horrible. I've been addicted. You know, I didn't go into, you know, heroin, but I was addicted to every pain pill possible for a very long time, 7 years of my life. And I wish I could have those 7 years back. And I know, I mean, there was times where I thought, oh my gosh, maybe if I just score a little bit of heroin right now, just to get through. And I started thinking in that mind frame that, but I tell you, this is always such a hard conversation to have with anybody who's going through that, because truly it is that question is like, when are you able to communicate with these people when they're not ready to have help? Are they ready to have help? So what are some of the things maybe you encourage them even if they say, hey, look, I'm not ready to get off of this. Have you had that conversation? Have you?
Yeah.
What are some of the things you would tell them?
I've had that conversation with people that I'm working with, you know, through what I do for a living, trying to get them into treatment. And to be honest, I've had a lot of those conversations with my friends, right? Like, I've had a lot of friends, a lot of actor friends, non-actor friends struggling with, I mean, we struggle, you know, I think that there's something that we go through as actors that, it's hard to explain if you're not in it. And that's why, like, we have an instant, like, relatability, right? An instant bond, because we just get it. We know, like, how fragile the psyche is and how easy it is to just take something to, like, quiet it long enough so you can just breathe, you know? So when I'm talking to someone that's wanting to come into treatment and they're not ready, what I have found is the best tool to use is to just share my story. Right? Sometimes it's just attraction rather than promotion. I mean, I'm not trying to push somebody into doing something they're not ready to do. But what I can tell them is about the decade that I struggled with addiction. And even the decade, this past decade, it has not been perfect and it has not looked pretty all the time. And if I share that story, sometimes it does inspire somebody else to be like, you know, if she did it, I can do it. And sometimes they're just not there. But you plant a seed and a lot of times they'll come back and they'll call me and say, hey, you know, I've been thinking a lot about what you told me and I think I might be ready. So I think just like keeping the mind frame of being willing to reach your hand out to somebody that needs help at all times. You just never know like what it could do for somebody.
Yeah. Being open, being able to communicate your story is very powerful. Absolutely. 100%. These, you know, you never know what's going to sort of break that mold for somebody who is struggling, but to look at somebody like yourself, that's willing to share a story. I mean, first of all, let's talk about that. I mean, you're telling a story you've had, you just kind of touched on, okay, the pressures of Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
And when we talk about the pressures of Hollywood, like people go, I want my kid to be in acting. I want to be an actor. I want to be a star. I want to be in television and film. The pressure that's there is undeniably excessive, which is why so much of the career becomes excessive. And because our, you know, so let's just go back to that a little bit. Like, what was that like truly? Did you feel pressure going on auditions, or was that something you felt naturally comfortable with, or was it something you felt like you were constantly coping with?
You know, it's interesting because I became so successful so early and things like really felt like they came easy to me, but not because I was just like a lucky kid. It's because I did have talent. And I put in the work, like I worked hard.
Yeah.
And I put acting first, you know, and that was what I did. I was an actor. That came before boys, before going to a normal school, before doing activities that could potentially hurt me and hinder my act. It came before everything. So was there a pressure? Yeah, there. But I think for me, the pressure came not from like worrying if I was going to book the audition or anything like that, but more so from growing up on television, right? So like I went through my entire puberty on television. My hair is much darker now, but I am a natural like orange, ginger, red hair. There's a lot to be said about growing up with that hair color. You have to have a very thick skin. And I went through like 2 or 3 years on television where I was not really cute. I don't know what I was very like interesting looking, you know, and I didn't hit that spot yet where I was like really pretty or hot or anything like that. And so I think for me, the pressure was as I continued to book these really big, big roles as like somebody's weird friend or,
how did that make you feel?
Somebody's goth friend. It made me feel like I had already been put into a box in Hollywood of a girl that's not pretty. So imagine you're 10, 11, 12 years old, these are very formative years, right? Of like growing up. And I'm constantly being told by managers, agents, Hollywood, casting directors, what have you, that like, oh, you know, we love Natanya, she's so talented, but she's not quite right for this, so we're just going to give her this instead. And I didn't realize it at that time, but it was developing some sort of a insecurity in me,
right,
that in just a few short years from then, I was going to start rebelling against, you know. And I don't think I had the proper structure around me of people telling me or even teaching me at that age that like beauty really comes from within. This is a lesson I had to learn decades later in my life, right? So I was constantly comparing myself to everybody else around me. And the feedback I was getting is like, you're the best, you're the most talented. But like nobody was telling me, you're so pretty, you're so nothing like that. So the pressure for me was I started pushing to audition for these roles that I really was not going to get cast in until much years later. And when I didn't get them, it just fed into that that thing that's always gone on in my brain that still happens to this day. That's like, you're not skinny enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not good enough. And then like what eventually happens, like you were talking about, you got to take that pill to just like, you know, fuck, I just need to take a breath here.
Just
like,
be, and feel normal again.
And that's happening at 11 years old, you know? So that was my pressure.
And you kind of just touched on a little bit about it too. Like people were not mentioning the fact that, hey, you're beautiful. You know, the roles that you're wanting to go out for. I have experienced in my 25 years in professional television too, you know, a lot of times it's your managers, your agents that are going, hey, you know, here's the bigger, better deal. And they tried to start, you know, and hey, that's a great thing to start trying to push towards those roles. But then you're getting feedback maybe at that young of an age where they're going, well, she's like the quirky best friend, not the leading lady.
Right. And also to counteract all of that, everyone around me is like, you're becoming famous. You're booking everything. You're making a shit ton of money. You're everything you wanted to happen is happening. And it was, and I felt that, and I felt that excitement,
sure,
but it was not happening in the way that I would have preferred at that age. And it started to lead to, you know, I think these hangups that I would eventually carry on for the rest of my life, you know?
Well, you've definitely turned that corner, and I want to talk a little bit about hangups and how we can get how you got through and how we can get through to others. What advice do you have for families who are coping with loved ones with addiction issues?
I'm sorry that you're going through this because I know how much it hurts. And I think the best thing I could say, having been somebody on the end of like the side that's hurting other people, is that it's not intentional. We're not doing anything to hurt you purposely. It's a disease of the mind that is not containable until you find a spiritual solution to it. So like all of the stuff that happens in between all of the people we hurt and screw over and break their hearts, like none of that is intentional. And this could be like an unpopular opinion, I don't know, but don't give up. Don't give up, because we never know when that chance is. Like if somebody's been to treatment 20 times, maybe the 21st time is going to be the one, you know, but keep your proper boundaries too. Your life is just as important. Your serenity, your peace is just as important. And if you have to create some sort of a boundary between you and your loved one that's suffering, that's okay too. But just never give up hope, because, you know, there's kids out there like me and a million others that sometimes it's that seventh try that sticks, you know, and you never know what they can go on and do with their life.
Yeah.
You never know how many people they can go on to help after, you know, being through what they've been through. So I think that's probably the best advice I could give.
That's fantastic advice. It takes time. It takes time for everybody to come to terms with whatever that is they're going through. And they can turn the mirror on themselves too, those families, and go, hey, what can we do better? How can we help them through this process? What are we maybe not completely doing right? Look, we're human beings. We're all going to make mistakes. Having the added pressure in your life, of course, you know, to, you know, those things you wanted to achieve, being in an entertainment industry where you are in the spotlight, those are added pressures. And would you say that because you were in TV and film that you had access to things that were not necessarily a girl your age around the rest of the country or world would have access to?
Yes, I would say that 100%. Young Hollywood in the 90s was, I mean, incredible and amazing. And also, like, people would go to jail now for some of the shit that went on back then. And yeah, I mean, everything was accessible to us. You know, I could walk into any club or bar in Hollywood at 14, 15 years old and be let in and be taken to the back, and there's bottle service, and then comes other stuff. And yeah, I was exposed to everything at a very early age. I started drinking at home. You know, you have to remember, I'm the sole breadwinner of the family at this point, right? I am starting to have a very difficult relationship with my mother because I'm starting to uncover things that she's doing that I don't feel comfortable with. And now I have this sense of entitlement with, like, well, do you want me to pay the rent this month? Do you want me to pay to get your hair done? Do you want all of these things done? And I am drinking at home with my friends, and that's it. So, you know, I really started to rebel at a very early age. I started smoking weed probably around 14 years old, and my mom had hired a guardian to take me to and from set. That's a thing with child actors, if anybody doesn't know, that if you're under 18, you have to have a legal guardian. Usually it's somebody's parent, and then sometimes they'll hire somebody and sign over, you know, legal guardianship so that person can take me to and from set. And it happened to be somebody who kind of partied with us, unfortunately. And that was the first time I got weed, was from that person. And and then it just, you know, it just snowballs. It snowballs and it snowballs. And by the time I was like 18 years old and we were really going out and really going to, and you feel that sense of independence and all of that, it was getting really messy at that point. But things are accessible to kids in Hollywood, at least back in my time. That, yeah, man, it was wild. Looking back, it was wild, you know?
I have to say, I mean, I was not in the 90s, but I was, 1997. And I have to say, like, I was not of age. I was 17, going into 18. And I was working on The Bold and the Beautiful at that time. And I was going to the Garden of Eden, you know, on La Brea and Hollywood Boulevard there. And I remember the very first time that I had really kind of experienced some of that was I was watching, you know, watching TV at home. And I remember Tommy Lee was going to go to jail because of the Pam Anderson abuse situation. And the next thing you know, I'm, you know, they're like, hey, Jacob, come on in, you know, go up to the VIP room. Next thing you know, there's like somebody pulling me over and there's Tommy. And I'm sitting next to him. And I'm like, whoa, bro, aren't you supposed to go to jail tomorrow? He's like, yeah, this is my last night of freedom, bro. And I was like, oh, no doubt. Really? This is it? This is, you know, he's like, yeah, do you want to roll to the next party with me? And of course, you know, at a younger, impressionable age, I was like, sure.
Of course you go.
The Testarossa pulled up. I was like, all right, let's roll. But that is like not real life to the rest of the world. And the pressures that are on that is just, I don't want to say that I want to take any of that back. And I'm sure that you don't want to take any of those experiences because you won't be who you are today.
Right.
But with that being said, like, that's just not the norm.
It's not. But you know, what's crazy is that back in that day, that was absolutely normal. That was like a normal Thursday night. You go to Garden of Eden and end up at a party with Tommy Lee or, I mean, 1,000 other people, you know, we could talk about. And our group of friends was so eclectic, but like everybody was famous or like up and coming or about to blow up. And we all knew it, you know, and we were, I started kind of getting my looks together a little bit and figuring out like how to make, it's like so weird to say, but
the awkward redheaded girl was now becoming a beauty.
Right. It's like, what's that movie? Rachel Cook. It's like She's All That.
She's All That.
You know,
sure.
I woke up one day and like everything was different and all these boys liked me and I was kind of in the middle of every like popular Hollywood circle there was. It was really crazy. And there was also, of course, a part of me that like really wanted to fit in. So when people were doing crazy shit and I just did it too, because I think there's a part of me that, because I come from like such a broken home, that I'm always looking to create family wherever I go. Right. And like back in those days, because I had no semblance of like who I was as a human being. And also like what that really looks like family, friends, a partner. Like I had no idea that I just conformed to whatever I needed to do to like fit in. You know, I was so desperate to belong to something and I had no idea that I was like, okay, just as I was.
Well, I can tell you that you're so okay now and beautiful in front of me and you've been through so much in your life.
Yeah.
My next question, you know, having a roof over our heads is something that most of us, you know, we take for granted.
For granted.
How does being homeless affect a person's mental health?
I love that you said that too, because that's when I speak about homelessness or helping the homeless community, that's one of the first things I say is like, I woke up this morning in a bed that has nice sheets on it with my fiance. I was able to get up, make a cup of coffee, sit on a couch, maybe even turn a television on for a minute, and then get in the shower and wash my hair and like have all the products that I needed. And this really is something that we take for granted on a day-to-day basis, you know? And there are, and that's still me too, P.S. There are times where, you know, I'm in my own way so much that I'm like, damn, at one point in my life, like I didn't even have a car or car keys or like an apartment, a key to an apartment to go home to, you know, and that'll put everything back into perspective really quickly. As far as like the mental health piece for homelessness, you know, I don't claim to know everything about the homelessness journey. I do know about mine. And I do know that from like the age of, I would say 17, when drugs started getting really bad for me, that by the time I was 21 years old, I was living in a car with two other child actors, P.S.
Wow.
That we had all just like you were saying earlier, like that thought you had when you're like, should I just get the heroin to get through? And something told you to turn right instead of turning left. Well, wow. I turned left and that's okay because that's part of my story, my journey. And like you said, it's like the reason why I get to sit here today and have these kinds of conversations with people. But you know, a lot of it was about a boy. Mm-hmm. You know, I got mixed up with the wrong person and that led to introduction to heroin. Mm-hmm. And I was only really able to keep it together for a couple of years. So imagine like 4 years ago, I am a successful actor. I have a great group of friends. I have a place to live. I'm, you know, seconds and inches away from booking the thing that's just going to catapult me to the next level. And then just a short few years later, I'm strung out on heroin. I've burned all the bridges I could. I have nobody to call and I'm living in a car with two other people. And we are literally scraping by on residual checks that are sent to a PO box and we're showering in a park once a week for $2. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. I live right by that park still. It's the Van Nuys Park. I'll never forget it. $2 to go shower and we do it once a week. I would try and, you know, have jobs here and there and just to, you know, have some like scraping by money. And the mental health, it's so crazy how God aligns everything. I literally last week was writing about this part of my life in the book. And I wrote in the book, I'll give you like a little snippet.
Yeah, please do.
The human psyche is so powerful and resilient. right? And I have always fancied myself a dreamer. I can fantasize anything in my life and make it a little better than it is or what have you. And you just learn to cope. Mm-hmm. You just learn to cope. So I find myself now living in a car, looking around at my life like, what did I do?
Well, that was what I was going to ask is what made that right turn then if you were going left?
Deep insecurity, the need to be loved because I wasn't able to, or I hadn't learned yet how to love myself. And then the attachment to a boy, you know, that was, it became accessible through this relationship, that drug. And that's where I made that right turn. And again, I don't regret any of it and I don't blame anybody. But I also think, I believe very strongly that like our lives are written for us long before we even enter this earth. And like, that was my path. Right. I was meant to be there. So when you wake up one day in a car and everything's gone and you have, again, no idea how you got there other than like, okay, it's actually pretty obvious, but like, it's almost that like, God, what happened? Why me? But you just learn to cope. And I just went into a different world. And that's when heroin really became sacred to me because mm-hmm. without that, I would have to really be aware of like what was going on in my life. At least with that, it was enough for me to pretend like something else was happening that was happening.
That's very powerful. Very powerful. And I mean, I've seen, you know, friends, many video clips of that exact thing. It's almost like a mask that's put on. It's a mask and you're not, no longer have to be aware. But when you became aware, mm-hmm. what was the next, what happened next?
So I eventually moved downtown LA. So we moved out of that car and found like a little kind of trap motel in downtown LA on 3rd and Alameda. I say all of these things out loud very often because I actually don't ever want to forget, you know, and it's also like I honor that part of my story. And it was just like a room, basically no bathroom, no kitchen, no anything. And the people in that were also living there were I just got like super emotional, like really thinking about it, you know, and then like looking up at the room I'm sitting in now, it's just something just happened to me. It was a lot of criminal activity, I'll say, going on in that building. And if I ever didn't think God had a different purpose for me in my life, if I think back on those times and the situation I was in and the surroundings and how dangerous it was, there was definitely something bigger meant for me in this lifetime, 100%. So we moved down there and I lasted maybe about a year and a half down there. And I think every like close call that happened down there, like one, there was one that happened and then I was just like, I can't do this. I can't do this. My mom was done with me at this point. And so we decided to go to a rehab up in San Francisco, took a train up there, detoxed, did the 35-day program, whatever it was. And then everybody came back, me and the two guys I was living with, and they decided to stay downtown. And I said, I'm going to call my mom. Mm-hmm. And my mom came and picked me up and she brought me back to the San Fernando Valley. And I went into a sober living and that was not the end of my addiction story, but that was the end of my heroin street life.
Yeah.
And that was done after that.
What did your mom tell you?
She was pissed. She was pissed. And, you know, we had, listen, it's such a cliche, like story. It's the same shit you've heard about a million other child actors turned 18. No money there. I'm smart enough to know how much I worked and there should have been a lot of money all of a sudden. Oh, I don't know, you know. And so I was so resentful already at her because of that. And in hindsight, like, that money might have really killed me. Honestly, I might have really killed myself with that money. Whatever, you know, everything happens for
a reason.
It's crazy. So I called her. She was pissed. But she said, okay, I'll come get you. She came and got me, and she had found some random, like, halfway house type of thing in the valley. She just dropped me off, and that was it. She said, you're on your own. And,
Did you get clean at that point?
I was clean for a little bit at that point, and then I started drinking. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay.
I'm not doing the heroin anymore, but I'm on alcohol and booze. Yeah.
That's right. Also, again, at this point, even though I'd had my stints in AA and rehab and all of this, no, like, real understanding of what the disease of alcoholism is. And it's like, it's almost a shame that we say the disease of alcoholism, because people relate it so much to an actual specific substance. And it's really just the need to put something outside of yourself in here, again, to quiet that voice. That, like, you're fucked up, you're a piece of shit, you're no good, you're not pretty, you're never gonna, that voice, like, long enough to breathe. It's anything. Like, alcoholism can look like anything. Gambling, shopping, that's a big one for me too. I need to actually get that under control. Shopping, food, another big one for me, right? Sure. Just because you take the substances away, if you're not spiritually maintained, you will grab for anything outside of you to just, like, shut everything down. So, you know, I had no understanding of any of that at that time. And, you know, I'm still in my 20s. I'm a kid. And so I start drinking. And, you know, there's some stuff that happened behind the alcohol that was very bad. And, I had been dating a boyfriend that I had been with a long time. And, you know, he had had problems with heroin before too. And obviously so did I. And we made a pact to each other, like, as long as we don't do that, we're cool. And we lasted about a year. And one night we broke the pact and we went back to his house, and he actually died in bed next to me.
Oh my gosh.
And I share this story a lot because, one, like, I can't ever forget what it felt like when I woke up and he was gone. Again, one more, like, tangible piece of evidence that God is just, like, not done with me.
No,
you know, sure. Like, that night was so dangerous because we had drank so much and we had been so far away from that specific drug that, like, somebody was meant to go. And, like, one more time, it wasn't me, you know. So I got sober after that. And
I'm, like, getting, like, crazy goosebumps from this, I have to say, like. I don't know if you can see him. It's just gnarly, but it actually brings me exactly to this question that I wanted to ask you. What are some of the most important lessons that you've learned in life, given everything on this outcome?
Man, that is, that's such a good question. And I just don't know that there's, like, a perfect answer to it, because there's so many answers, right? Like, what I learned after that experience specifically is that 100% everybody has a specific plan. Like, this young man that passed away, I'd known him since I was 13. Mm. You know, we had had a couple little rendezvous, and I loved him so much. And, you know, obviously life is short. And Jacob, that's a tough one. That's a tough one for me to tap into, because when I think of how to, like, try and answer that question, I don't feel like it's beautiful enough to, like, honor the fact like, I'm still here and
everything that you've overcome through that scenario?
Sure. So I knew sharing that story would be important. And I have made sure to share in a general way what happened that night with as many people as I could. And there have been many people who have come to me and said, hey, I heard you talking about this situation. I just went through that, and hearing that you got through it helped me stay sober, or whatever the situation is. You know, I'll tell you, there's not been a day that it's been, that was 2008, I think 16 years. And there hasn't been a day that's gone by that I haven't thought about him. And in the most like troubling times I've had in my life in the last 16 years, and I'm like, wait, how did I just like overcome that again? I'm like, you know, and then this is a really interesting thing too. The day that he died, the date is actually my fiance's birthday. So for all these years, like 9, 10 years, that day was such like a sad thing. And I think that like he gave my fiance to me as a gift to make sure somebody would be there to like take care of me for the last part of my life, you know? And that day has become about something very different, like remembering how important it is to cherish your loved ones.
Divine intervention comes to mind.
Sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Please.
Jacob, you weren't expecting all this.
I wasn't, but I have to say I accept it, and yeah. I embrace all of it. This is what this show is about.
Yeah.
You know, there's only so much that when I was, you know, talking with you early on, your bio, you know, guys, you're going to be tuning into this anyway. So, there's only so much I knew, but I don't know the details. I don't know the details until I'm talking to you about this. I have to say though, a true heartfelt, you are a warrior, you are a survivor. There is a reason, and God had that reason to keep you, telling your story and helping all the people that you've helped so far. Tell our listeners some of the things that they can do to help some of the organizations that you founded and help them to overcome these same.
Sure. The first, I think, most important thing I could ever say is that, like, if you are struggling, reach out to somebody. Reach out. The more we keep inside, the sicker it makes us. And for me, there have been many times where it was so, even stone cold sober in sobriety, where it's so hard to pick up that phone and say, I'm struggling, I need help. But do it, because it will save your life. I try and answer as many DMs as I can and comments and stuff like that. Even if you just want to message me like, hey, I'm in Ohio, not sure what my resources are, I am happy to help you with that at any time. So I founded San Fernando Valley Feed the Homeless. It's an organization where we go out onto the street and bring food and clothing and blankets when we can, and just provide a meal and some hope. And right now, what I've been mainly doing is working with an organization called Hope of the Valley. I had to stop some of my events during COVID because they're very large. We couldn't get that many people together. And I teamed up with Hope of the Valley, and I was absolutely blown away by what they were doing. And I got involved very quickly and started fundraising. And they are creating tiny home communities for people that are on the street and bringing them off the street and into the shelter of a tiny home. And it is so much more and so much deeper than that, because you can't just bring somebody that's been living off on the street into a tiny home and like, boom, bam, everything's
expect
great.
Them to be okay.
Right. Exactly. So there's counseling provided, therapeutic services, medical services, 3 meals a day. They have access to the thrift store where they can get an entire new wardrobe. And basically it's considered like the last step before permanent housing. So they're assigned a counselor, a case manager, and this case manager helps them all the way through the process. If they, of course, there's no drugs allowed, no violence, nothing like, you know, obviously, of course. And if they are compliant with everything, as most people are, because they're being given a second opportunity at life. It's insane, you know? And, so that organization is called Hope of the Valley. And I think you're linking it or something. You know, and also too, if you want more information, you can always reach out to me on DMs about that kind of stuff too, about my organization or Hope of the Valley. I feel very passionately about this. There was once a Thanksgiving that I was in a food line at the Midnight Mission downtown LA. I was probably about 21 years old. And just 5 years prior, I had been an incredibly successful child actor. And now I'm in a homeless line on Thanksgiving, just waiting for like a box of juice, an apple, a sandwich, and a pair of socks. And I will never forget how that felt. And I'm willing to do anything I can do for somebody who really wants to make that positive change in their life.
I served that line several times over the years, and I know I know it very well. Thank you so much for all that you're doing, and all you're doing for people. Gosh, making me emotional now. God,
I know. I've had to hold it back. Like, I know.
thank you so much for that. One of the questions I ask every single person that comes on my show is if you can take a ride in the Jacob Young time machine, and your time machine is a little bit different than most, because if you could speak to Natanya, who was working on TV for Nickelodeon at the time, what would you say to yourself?
I'd probably catch her at around, you're going to make me cry now. I'd probably catch her at around 14 years old, and I would tell her it's okay. It's okay. I would tell her to be careful with the people that you surround yourself with, and to remember that, like, above anything else in life, just be a nice person. That's all that matters. The rest of this is bullshit. Be a good, kind person, and take care of yourself. And I give her like a really big hug and whisper in her ear, "You're beautiful, no matter what." So
the last question that I have for you in our time that we have together today, my sponsor Boys Town, is their motto is "He ain't heavy, he's my brother." And that goes back to 100 years or early on during Father Flanagan, while he was stepping outside the Jim Crow law, integrating children long before the 1960s. He had very limited amounts of money to help children, even some that were handicapped. And the boys would take turns carrying around a couple of the kids that could not have access to wheelchairs and or any kind of equipment to get them around. So they would carry them to football games or baseball games or classes. And one day Father said, "Isn't he heavy?" And he said, "He ain't heavy, Father. He's my brother." Meaning in our lives, somebody has carried us. Who's carried you?
A lot of people. There are a lot of people to thank, or I would not be sitting here right now. Jacob, there's been so many people. I really believe that, like, had it not been for the kindness of strangers, I wouldn't be alive. And if it hadn't been for the perseverance and resiliency of my friends, I wouldn't be here. I have friends from when I was 13 years old. One of my friends, Jenna. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But I'll talk more recently. The person who carries me in my life now the most is my fiance, and he does it without even knowing he's doing it. And I finally, I'm going to cry again. I finally, for the first time in my life, felt like I've created a partnership with somebody that's equal. And I know that, like, regardless of anything, like, I am okay now. And because of that, because I'm able to love myself truly for the first time in my life, like, I can let him love me in a way that I've never let anybody else love me. I love the what you said, he's not heavy, he's my brother. That is so beautiful. And, you know, if I can just end with, like, what my motto in life is and my saving grace is that the more I think about you, the less I think about me. Oh. You know, the more I think about you, the less I think about me. And Jacob, if I'm left to my own devices, I will just sit and think about myself and only myself. you know, and get into that like very actory kind of don't you know who the fuck I am type of thing. But that's not the way to be in life. That's not what we were, how we were meant to think. No. Really, truly, the more I think about you, the less I think about me.
Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me today, Natanya. You are making such a positive impact in the world today because of everything that you've endured. You're really making a big, big difference and literally saving lives. So thank you for your honesty and all of the important help that you're giving to all of those that are in need. And I wish you continued success in everything that you do.
Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure. And I wish all the same for you and your beautiful family. And what a beautiful last hour and 5 minutes we've been able to share together, truly.
I appreciate you and all the time that you gave to us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That's about all the time that we have for today. Real Conversations with Jacob Young. The Mental Health Podcast is sponsored by Boys Town. Boys Town, their slogan is, "He ain't heavy, he's my brother." And for over 100 years, Boys Town has been saving children, healing families. They're only one call away, and they're always there to help. So please go to boystown.org for all the details on how to access Boys Town's mental health services. Or simply just go to yourlifeyourvoice.org. If you are in crisis, or you do need immediate help, please call the trained counselors at the Boys Town National Hotline at 800-448-3000 or text VOICE to 20121. Thanks for joining me on Real Conversations. I'm Jacob Young. Till next time, love yourself and love each other.